Hello and welcome back to Big Mouth, the boiling pressure cooker of pop culture, where we stuff the new TV, music, films and other stuff into the pan and reduce them to a nourishing and possibly edible bouillabaisse. I'm Andrew Harrison, and joining me as usual is Sean Pattenden, the Fanny Craddock of rock and roll, to my stooped and balding Johnny. Hello, Sean, how are you doing?
I'm happy with that. Yeah. I'm doing all right, thanks, Andrew.
Have you been enjoying old cinema guys hate on superhero movies week this week?
I've been really enjoying it. Yeah, sadly, yeah. I love seeing them moan, the
it's
old
great, isn't it?
Gits. Yeah.
Ken Loach saying superhero movies, Marvel movies are boring and nothing to do with cinema, and Francis Ford Coppola saying they are despicable and we don't gain any enlightenment, knowledge or inspiration from them.
I mean, well, I never. That's all I can say.
Nutritional value of crisps low in shock news reports.
Exactly. It's just go and watch them. Just yes. To sit down and watch a load of Marvel, but so-called Coppola. Yeah.
Isn't this exactly what their own dads said about the cowboy and the gangster movies they watched when they were kids? Yeah. It's rubbish. Why don't you go and watch a nice comic opera or go to the vaudeville? That's much better for you.
It's totally that. We're going to laugh at them because they're so old and out of touch now, though, aren't we?
I suppose we can. Mm. Can you picture Ken Loach as Captain America then? Massacring innocent Central American protesters, or Iron Man lying in a pool of money like Scrooge McDuck?
I kind of can, though. I mean, maybe Ken Loach should sort of go into their franchise. I think that might be quite good.
I think Ken
Captain
Loach
should... Nottingham or
Captain
something.
Captain Nottingham. Well, somebody did do a Superman, Ken Loach's Superman spoof where he just sat in the pub and moaned. But I do think he would do a very good Spider-Man because Peter Parker is a working class kid and there'd be lots of boring scenes from lining up for his zero-hour contract work. That would be very good.
Half boy, half kestrel.
Half boy, half kestrel.
That's nice.
Follower of the show, Stuart Houghton, did Photoshop the Falcon from the Avengers onto Kez's shoulder, which I thought was pretty good. A kestrel for a knave. By the way, before we move on to important things, there's a brilliant joke from Milo, son of listener William Higham. What do you get if you cross Black Panther with Deadpool?
What?
Blackpool. Yeah. That's quite good. Anyway, we've got your RDA of comic book adaptations later in the podcast as we talk about HBO's adaptation or remix or extension or whatever of Watchmen with Doreen Linsky from our partner podcast Romaniacs. Plus, we'll be talking about the BBC's new prestige international crime drama Giri Haji, which I hope I'm pronouncing correctly, Yakuza sword murders in London, Kelly MacDonald on dating sites, male prostitutes in a pub literally yards from this very studio. It's got the lot. Dukes of Stratosphere were perhaps the greatest and most authentic fake band in pop history. XTC pretending to be a great lost psych band from the late 60s and creating pitch-perfect recreations of Pink Floyd, Strawberry Alarm Clock, The Electric Prunes and Sgt. Pepper-era Beatles. Everything they did has just been re-released in surround sound as Surroundabout Ride with a P, get it? Yeah, I'm going to talk about it for no reason other than it's great. And The Laundromat, the new Netflix movie based on the Panama Papers. Meryl Streep starring, Steven Soderbergh directing, and two real-life lawyers trying and failing to prevent its release. Don't forget, you can get Big Mouth a day early if you back us on the Patreon crowdfunding platform. Pledge us the price of a pint every week and you'll get Big Mouth as soon as it's ready, plus an exclusive extra bit just for you, our supporters. As it's a TV-heavy week, we're going to be choosing some less well-known box sets for your autumn binging pleasure. Pledge us the price of 2 pints a month and you'll get the sought-after Big Mouth mug too, as pictured on social media right now. I am drinking tea out of one. I can attest that it actually works. So search Patreon Big Mouth to find out more. All we're saying is buy us a pint. Sean, who is going to help us with all this stuff?
Well, he's a Big Mouth regular, author of Mars by 1980, The Story of Electronic Music, a Melody Maker veteran and a long-suffering follower of Association Football Team, The Arsenal. It's David Stubbs. Hello, David. Welcome back. How are you?
Long-suffering, yes. Arsenal, let's give some context there. Arsenal lost to Sheffield United the other night.
You'll get over
it. Mr. Sheffield United. Next time I watch Game of Thrones, I'm going to be cheering when Joffrey beheads...
Hey, spoilers, man. Yeah. It was only 10 years ago.
Andrew stalks you on Facebook, apparently, and notes that you have been giving advice, one of which is never, ever try to change a duvet cover while listening to Sun Ra.
That is correct,
yes. You can do one, you can do the other, but never try to do the two simultaneously. What happened, David?
I think, as I went on to say, there's cosmic confusion, entanglement, certainly rich expletives rent the air. It didn't work. I mean, there was a good technique. There's a way of doing it. You turn the duvet cover inside out, catch both ends, grab one end of the duvet and shake. I mean, and it should work. But I don't know, during one of the extended clavier solos from Sun Ra or whatever, something went awry in my kind of,
It sounds wonderful.
Yes.
It sounds like you went into a different dimension. It used to be a standard Smash Hits question was, can you change a duvet and how? do you do it? And people would then have to explain, and you'd either get whether they're a proper pop star and they actually pay someone else to do it, or they do it by the two ears, as I always call it, you know, back to front. But then I think it's a better question now. Can you change a duvet cover to Sun Ra? Which I'll be asking my next pop star that I see. Now, are you aware of the social media phenomenon USA Soccer Guy, who explains football in terms an American fan would appreciate? Okay,
yes.
Tell us about him. He refers to the Arsenal as London Soccer Cannons.
London Soccer, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, and the football. Yes, I can't quite do all the particular argument, but I am familiar with his work, and I'm sure he made hay of Monday night's tragedy.
He has great transfer news, like Irish guy Mick O'Tarion gets his lame kilt-wearing ass shipped out of London Arsenal.
Should we hand him over to Match of the Day, do you think?
I think he definitely should host Match of the Day.
I think he should host most things. I need to see this man.
What's going on in the end zone penalisation area? Anyway, our next guest is Lucy O'Brien, author of the classic Dusty Springfield biography, now out in a revised and updated edition. Before we say hello to Lucy, let's get in the mood with a bit of Dusty from 1967. This is Give Me Time.
If you'll only give me
Hello, Lucy O'Brien, biographer of Dusty Springfield. Welcome back to Big Mouth. How are you doing?
I'm doing really well, thank you.
I'm glad to hear it. Now, your book originally came out in 1989, just as Dusty was kind of reborn with the Pet Shop Boys and What Have I Done to Deserve This? And she died in 1999. There's another 10 years of life to cover. What did you learn about in that subsequent period? What did you discover?
Well, it's been really interesting updating it. I thought it was going to be quite a quiet update. It's to coincide with a new film called So Much Love, starring Gemma Arterton, which is going into production soon.
And Gemma Arterton's going to play Dusty?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Yes, yes. So I thought, well, I'll just... And I did some extra interviews, and then I started to look at her story anew. And it was like I saw her with completely new eyes and saw her achievement with completely new eyes. And I thought, my goodness, here we are. There's a woman who's a lesbian who's in the closet, who feels that she can't come out, who's really tortured, suffers severe anxiety, depression, addiction issues, and yet storms it with just the most amazing catalogue of songs. And her voice, I mean, she has become, I would say, arguably one of our best British singers. So I was kind of looking at that story anew and really thinking about what it took, the single-mindedness it took for her to push through what she wanted. And a lot of it was to do with the sound. And I remember talking to Ivor Raymond, who has since passed away, the arranger, father of Simon Raymond, Cocteau Twins, who said, yeah, Dusty was like a hard case. You know? Anne Shelton or Vera Lynn would come in and sort of sing their songs and then go home. But she would stay and she'd really push for a sound that was was quite unpopular in Britain at the time. They weren't really clued into that more soulful pop sound. And she really pushed for that with the musicians and made herself a bit unpopular with that.
In the studio, apparently, isn't that story where she didn't think the acoustics were at all right, so she went to the toilet and sent it, what I want, that's the echo I want.
Well, the thing that's interesting, I've been looking at this and thinking, well, actually, seriously, now she would get a co-production credit on just about all her work. Mm. And then because of the sexism of the time, of course she didn't get a producer credit at all. But she really was one of the architects of that kind of modern British pop sound.
It's certainly what something that gets imitated on a kind of roughly 10-year cycle, doesn't it? And your Duffy appears being Dusty.
Yes.
And we'll probably we're due another one, aren't we? We're due a return of Dustyism. She was also pretty much the first of the 60s and 70s artists to be kind of rediscovered by fans who were now themselves pop stars, as happened with the Pet Shop Boys. That thing that we subsequently saw with, Johnny Cash and, it was actually before Tom Jones as well. It wasn't before Tom Jones was kind of reactivated. Why had her stock fallen in the 80s before that reinvention?
Why had her stock fallen?
Yeah, because it was kind of... For a lot of people, when the Pet Shop Boys came, when she came out with the Pet Shop Boys, it was like, yes. Where has she been?
Well, when I first researched the book in the 80s, I mean, I did an interview with her, and this was shortly after the success of What Have I Done to Deserve This? Sidgwick and Jackson, the publisher, said, you want to write a book about her? And I was, yes. But it was a real challenge because it was very hard to track down. There was this whole 10 years that had been a lost 10 years, basically the 1970s and 80s, when she was in... she moved to LA. And I think she suffered from being a white, home counties British woman on the American music scene. They just didn't get the fact that she wanted to sing soul music. They wanted to sort of stick her in a gown and put her on the stage in Las Vegas. Mm. But she wanted to sing, like, keep recording with Atlantic, keep recording with cutting-edge producers. And she ended up, her confidence just gradually being undermined. And then there were a number of years where it was just, sadly, drink and drugs, unfinished recordings, kind of recording sessions that were half done. And at one point, I interviewed one of her managers who said she was living in a kind of halfway house and had no money. And, you know, and this was quite shocking to discover all this. Then people didn't really know what had happened to her. And there was a lot that I couldn't put in the original edition because of that. And I've, with this update, I've been able to look at that and explore that in more detail.
She does make a fantastic record as well after that that single. She has Reputation, which has got In Private on it, which is one of the most incredible songs. Yeah. If people are going to get one Dusty album, what should it be?
Oh, God, that's such a good question. You know, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, Dusty in Memphis is obviously the classic and it's on, you know, all the best of lists. And I agree, you know, you had that amazing triumvirate there with Jerry Wexler and Arif Mardin and Tom Dowd. But I was listening recently to It Begins Again, which came out in 1978. And I thought, my goodness, this is just a great example of that kind of what they called the blue-eyed soul sound. And it had elements of almost like Todd Rundgren. And she was working with session players that were really at the top of their game, you know, some of the Steely Dan players. And I actually really like that period where she's kind of... There's a bit of disco and there's, you know, that soulful.
I mean, it sounds trite, but I think that disco is a kind of really important component with somebody like Dusty Springfield because throughout the 80s, I mean, I used to sort of run a club in Oxford and it was actually a gay club mostly. Yeah. So it was a lot of high energy at that time and it made me realise just the importance of divas, you know, in that particular culture. And, of course, how widespread that was and people like Donna Summer, etc., Gordana or whatever. And I thought, well, she'd be perfect for all of that. And it seems to have happened slightly belatedly, really.
Yes, I mean, she was the perfect diva. There's a lovely story of her. She would regularly have, had this whole coterie of gay men who'd hang out at her house and they'd all try on her gowns and things.
Well, it's funny you should mention that, Alan, because we might be hearing a bit of it later. Who knows? Stay tuned, listeners. Yes. Do you stay tuned to a podcast? You just keep it playing, don't you? You don't move the dial. Anyway, let's move on to Giri Haji, the new prestige international drama on BBC Two. We've got sharp-dressed Yakuza, a Japanese copper with a dead gangster brother, or is he? Kelly MacDonald is a British detective, frosty conversations in offices above Tokyo fish markets, and a Japanese corpse on the floor of a London apartment with a ceremonial sword sticking out of his back. The title translates as shame stroke duty, and the scriptwriter is Joe Barton, who wrote Humans on Channel 4, the one about the robots. Does Giri Haji have what it takes to become your new binge obsession? Here's a flavour of what it's like.
I'm looking for my brother. They told me he has done something terrible. I'm here to take him home.
I think you know the man in the mugshot. Is Kenzo in trouble?
Not my place to say. A lot of drama, though.
We're not bad people. We just did bad things.
Every decision we make can affect everyone around us.
David Stubbs, how are you on the Japanese bloodbath gangster genre? Is it your cup of sake?
Yeah. I always had this kind of mistrust of any kind of new major heart-hitting BBC drama or whatever because there are so many sort of tropes and cliches and things like that, you know, and for instance, you know, a plot where, you know, it all goes all the way to the top, you know, something like that. Can't I just go all the way to the middle somewhere or something like that? Just have to the bloody top every time. Yeah. Cliches and things like that. You can also see the expediency of having it in kind of multiple international locations, you know, and is that the real reason you're doing it or is it essential to the plot, et cetera, et cetera. But I did enjoy this. I only watched the first episode, but I thought this is set up really nicely because there's all kinds of sort of, there's many kind of potential tangents and directions and characters that are going to be, hopefully are going to stick around because they're kind of funny or whatever, diverting and what have you. I also like the way that it plays around, again, you know, with the whole, the tropes, the sort of rhythms of conventional BBC heavyweight drama. It seems to escape them nicely. I think the influence of the Japanese influence does that. There were times when I thought, I am actually watching a foreign film. Yeah. You know, and sometimes when one watches a foreign film, what you're sort of really enjoying is the kind of alternative sort of rhythms, the dialogue, and feel, the different grammar. Exactly, yeah. I mean, you know, one of the very first things that happens in it, there's this kind of massive shootout.
Yeah.
Sort of St. Valentine's Day type massacre. And I thought, okay, this is going to be silly. But I, once, you know, I got over that, and it's fine, you know, and it's fine. Yeah, I really dug into it. I think that this is it's going to go places. I have no idea what places, and I'm going to stick with it.
Yeah, I thought it was, for a start, immensely stylishly shot. There's those two great scenes. The first thing we see is the guy who turns out to be the initial murder victim coming home, Japanese businessman coming home in London, just sorting out his apartment, and he places a whiskey glass down, and there is an immediate cut to an evidence tag on that whiskey glass. And I thought, what a great way to introduce a crime. And they're shooting again in the restaurant in Tokyo that you described, also done beautifully, stylishly. But the really crazy thing is the way it keeps leaping into literally different genres of film. Yeah. So there's a bit of animation.
That animation thing, that's Black Earth Rising, which comes out in 1980, also uses something like that. It's a really, really effective device.
I also like the way that the flashbacks, the policeman and his bad brother, which is in its own way a bit of a cliche, but those flashbacks are shot in kind of, you know, with a canted camera and lots of red and blue light. It's like a Japanese 80s action movie. And then suddenly you're back on Shoreditch Road and it's rainy and it's grey. I thought it was brilliant kind of mixture of styles like that. Lucy O'Brien, how are you on crime stuff like this? Did you like this?
I really enjoyed it. And I love the contrast with Kelly MacDonald. So you've got Kenzo, the Japanese detective, who's kind of very serious and has this dark, brooding, and you know there's some secrets there. And then Kelly, who seems all kind of bright and ditzy and is on this kind of dating app, has very, very awkward sex.
Yeah. Really, it's like sexy sex I've ever seen on television.
Very bad bed linen and horrible decor. Yeah. And then the surreal twist where someone sticks a snake into her letterbox, so to speak.
Quite literally. Yes.
But there's, I like those layers, and I think Kelly MacDonald's always so watchable. I think she's becoming one of the great British actresses in a way. It wouldn't surprise me after this if she gets a detective, female detective part like Helen Mirren did with Prime Suspect. But I like the contrast and that flavour of Tokyo life as well. Yeah. And all those editing techniques. The editing is amazing.
Humans, the Android drama that he did for Channel 4, which I thought was great, was largely about the inability of human beings to fully understand this kind of parallel society, parallel world of minds that they created. And it's a similar thing going on here, isn't it? Because you've got the world of the Japanese detective, which is quite austere and quite serious. I mean, it's a way sort of plays around with cliches of what we in the West think about Japanese people. Mm. But the kind of the interplay between the cops and the accuser is very operatic, and then you come to Britain and they're like sitting in a call centre tapping away on crappy kind of, you know, crap off-brand keyboards, and she's on a crap dating
app. Almost like they've done it as crap as possible.
It's like if you were to pitch this, it's like, he's a super Japanese detective, she's crap and can't get the filing system to work. Together it was murder. And there's the crowded flat thing at home in Japan where he's kind of living with his mother but also his parents and his daughter who's going off the rails. Which, at home, if that was an English detective story with a British detective, you think it is a little bit of a cliche. You know, I've got all my presents. But something in it managed to spin it and make it exciting.
Yeah.
Sean, what did you think?
Similar to David, I thought this is starting to tick the boxes as it's sort of, oh, it's a Japanese detective and he's going to go to London, so he's going to get both. And it's going to be really dry and it's going to be really humourless and you know, you start watching it, Kelly MacDonald appears, and she is a ray of sunshine in this. She is so good. She lights up the screen. She's really funny. Her very, as we're saying, her crappy parochial world and his, I'm the detective, I'm very serious, I'm an international, you know, force. It's wonderful. The way they gel, it's wonderful. You see bits of London you don't normally see. You just see horrible bits of London. Yeah. A bit of the Charing Cross Road that's not very nice.
Doesn't he meet someone in a cafe off Leicester Square?
Yes, and the my favourite bit, yes, is Will Sharp is in it. So Will Sharp plays this rent boy.
Great.
Yes,
and
he wrote Flowers and starred in it, which is a wonderful series too. And as soon as he came on, again, it was, light up the screen. Yes. This is so good. Yeah. Lots and lots of stereotypes are being upended, I think, in this programme. He is fabulous. And you know there's some dark secrets behind there and someone is trying to...
I don't know about you, Sean. I'm sick and tired of Anglo-Japanese male sex workers. The television is full of them.
He's just wonderful. And he's just so like someone on the club scene in the 1990s that you would know. I think, and so I really, really warmed to it and thought I would watch more. It's not paraded. I don't think the marketing's very good on it. It's paraded as something terribly serious and, say, an international. But it seems to be really rather wonderful, and just these pockets of eccentricity within it are so lovely.
And it's also, and this is a compliment, it's kind of slow. It kind of takes
I found
time.
It too fast because I'm a pretentious Japanese film fan. So I like Ozu and Mizoguchi, who have many, many shots and many scenes where no one says anything at all. Well, just a couple of things. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of talking in the first half hour and I found it quite difficult to keep up with.
Do you want
with.
People sitting silently in cafes looking at a cup of coffee?
Of course I do. Really long shots. And the shot has to be from the floor. It can't be from head height. It has to be from the floor. That's what I demand in my...
One thing I really liked about it as well is it didn't seem to have a big thing to say about the world. The way BBC drama needs to be saying important things.
Like the Capture had to say lots of important things. This doesn't bother with that.
How we live today, this is a really important statement. No, this is just, this is what it's like to be two different kinds of cop in a world that's kind of, you know, all workplaces to the people working there are kind of boring, aren't they? They're all, that's what work is. Work is what you do when you're not having fun and maybe riveting to us. Yeah. But, you know, it kind of manages to take that... to make the tedium of work kind of compelling by looking at it from two different cultural angles. I love all the little tiny details as well. There's a great bit where Kenzo is catching a cab at Paddington. He's trying to catch a cab and he doesn't know that you need a yellow light. But then the cab that he does get, he gets out and he turns to bow and thank and the cab just drives off. And there's a little moment where he's like, God, who are these people?
Yes.
I thought that kind of attention to detail.
As always with that exiting the cab scene, it's never quite clear when he actually paid.
Didn't actually pay in a shot that we saw, but maybe that was cut. Yeah.
Maybe he paid before he got out of the cab.
Well, of course, people do, don't they? You know, paying through the window, do you or don't you?
Well, yes.
Do you live in London?
It also explores
that. But it's interesting we all notice that. Yeah. Sometimes...
See, if you always take this shortcut, like, no one ever says goodbye when they put a phone down, which I always think is
unbelievable. People always have the right change as well in shots.
And also, whenever anybody says, and this happens in Girihaji, whenever anybody says, turn on the news, it's all showing the story that they need to know about.
The golf, the weather, the end of the regional news. 6-7 minutes later.
Something else that we'll talk about later in the show is going to talk about people receiving news in a fictional context, which I thought was really instructive. But basically, we love it, don't we? We're going to stick with it. And they're all on iPlayer, so we can watch them all at the weekend.
And good on Kelly MacDonald. Can we have more of her? Because she disappeared.
I agree.
She was
brilliant in Boardwalk Empire. I mean, that was as somebody probably not really seen much of it since, you know, Trainspotting or whatever. I thought she's tremendous.
Right, let's have some music. We always ask the guests to bring in a fancy tune for your education and or entertainment. David Stubbs, what have you brought in for us this week?
Right, this is Satellite. Stephen Malander, formerly of Cabaret Voltaire, and his new album called Dada. He's a lovely bloke. He's in his probably in his early 60s now. But Cabaret Voltaire was first started operating about 1972, and their very name refers to the original sort of location of the Dada movement in Zurich.
I've been there.
Have you?
It's just a kind of cafe type thing now. Voltaire. Yeah.
Yeah. Indeed. Yeah. So it stretches right back to 1916. So obviously that kind of has always chimed in with my idea of like electronic music and its long prehistory, and that's very strongly referenced on this album, you know, with Dada in the title. In fact, this album is, he's kind of revisiting that kind of weird little period about 85, 86, just before techno broke, the kind of sort of proto-techno period. And he sort of almost like limits himself in terms of the kind of rhythms to that particular period, Rhythms and the Feel. It's almost a sort of homage to that time. What I love about this particular track is that you're used to sort of hearing Stephen when he sings. It's usually very sort of growly and hissy or whatever, but he makes wonderful use of, like, you know, vocal manipulating technology or whatever, and which I absolutely love. I mean, I think that one of the last sort of electrophobic things these days is people hating things like, you know, like auto-tune and stuff like that. But I think it can be a wonderful thing.
Down with electrophobia.
Wonderful. Let's listen. Satellite by Stephen Mallinder.
Now, in sharp contrast, in the epic megapop days of 1985, few things were as out of kilter as the mysterious Dukes of Stratosphere, supposedly a great lost band from the glory days of psych rock, rediscovered in all their paisley glory in some record fair somewhere. Sir John Johns, E.I.E.I. Owens, The Red Curtain and Lord Cornelius Plum turned out to be XTC in disguise, and their two records, It's 25 O'Clock and Personic Sunspot, turned
well
out
done.
To sell more than XTC's real records did, even though they were recorded for £5,000 and £10,000 respectively. Dukes of Stratosphere re-energised XTC. They were responsible for the band's flowering as a cosmic pastoral pop world of wizardry. They inspired the Paisley Underground, and they led Cooler Shaker, the Stone Roses and the Shaman all to recruit producer John Leckie for their own records. All the Duke stuff is out now again in surround sound as Surroundabout Ride. Here's the emblematic track. Tune in, turn on, drop out. It's Dukes of Stratosphere. Say it's 25 o'clock.
The ticking seconds hear their call. My spell on those will make you fall. Each timer that I break will hold the flowing sand.
Clocks, mellotrons, backward tapes, what more do you need? David Stubbs, XTC said they had more fun in the studio here than at any time before or since. Can you tell?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a strange sort of exercise to have been conducted in that sort of period. Was it 1984? And it just feels completely out on a limb to do something like this.
That stuff was at its lowest kind of hypnotism, yeah. Wasn't it? Unless you were really hipping.
As crazy. Perhaps XTC themselves were at that particular point. 84 is a funny year because things were really sort of turning in a very different direction at that point. So it doesn't surprise me, perhaps, that Nothing Left This did sell more than what they were doing at the time. I mean, XTC, they're a funny group. I kind of got slightly late to punk and Pugs Punk, but I did like XTC a lot. Mm. But then as soon as I started getting into Joy Division, I sort of dropped it. XTC like a hot tail, too clever.
Too much fun.
Too quirky. Too much fun, exactly. Not to see the state of the world.
Stop having fun.
Joy Division.
Yeah.
Come on.
So, yes.
So I always thought, you know, in a stern young man as I was, I kind of dropped them for a while and perhaps didn't really sort of pick them up again for quite a long time. Oddly enough, I think Stupidly Happy was the thing that got me back into that lovely track in the 90s. But this is, I mean, I have a slight limit myself, I suppose, for this kind of pastiche in terms of, you know, it's not something that I kind of go for in a huge way. But I think this is, this is as much fun as I could sort of expect to have from it. I love it. I mean, there's various, I think the references are pretty conspicuous, and there's, I mean, Bike Ride to the Moon, I think, is presumably, by the sound of it, it's like My White
Bicycle yes.
Tomorrow, yeah, which I think Nazareth covered, didn't they? I seem to remember. What else we got? There's a bit of Hawkwind, I think, in there, all those arcing synths, My Love Explodes, and Pink Floyd all over the shop. I mean, yes. There's so much that's sort of, you know, that's Sid Barrett era, Pink Floyd, Pipe at the Gates of Dawn. So many.
And the track that we heard, 25 o'clock, is so electric, Prince. It's quite.
Yeah, hilarious, yeah. A Mole from the Ministry, presumably that's a reference to the Moles. Then there's a Beach Boys one as well, is it Pale and Precious,
yeah, which
with
is
those
really
kind
lovely.
Of. Yeah, those yeah. lovely little plotted chord and harmonies. But I mean, I understand that they really had a strong preference for English psychedelia. They felt that American psychedelia was too angsty and too sort of overshadowed Vietnam and all that kind of thing. There's a sort of toy box feel, I suppose, yeah. about UK psychedelia.
It's all very Guardsman's Jackets that Granny Takes a Trip, isn't it? Which is dead good fun.
Yes.
Lucy, what did you think of it? Did you get what did you? You were working in Her Majesty's Rock and Roll Press at the time.
Yeah.
When it just begun. What did you make of it then? And what do you think of it
yeah.
now?
Yeah. No, and I remember it coming out and it being billed as this sort of forgotten '60s gem. And I really liked it then, and I really like it now because I've got quite a soft spot for '60s psychedelia, particularly the UK psychedelia and kind of that '67 thing with lots of reverb and echo and. Kind of revisiting childhood, but in a very surreal way. And I think they perfectly capture it on 25 O'Clock. And then they, because that was so successful, they went and did the follow-up, Sonic Sunspot, which I'm not so into, because with that one, it's more outtakes from some of the XTC sessions, isn't it? Sort of slightly reworked in a psychedelic way. And I find that a little more cerebral. It's not quite as spontaneous as the 25 O'Clock. But when I was listening to it, the other day, I was thinking, gosh, there's some tracks here that actually could be the link between that new wave and Britpop, you know, Blur.
Oh, I absolutely bet Damon Albarn hammered this one.
Yes, yeah. yes. You can really hear it there. So, yeah, it's quite interesting. What I like as well is the story behind this, that Andy Partridge was really not in a good way, say, in the early 80s. Lots of touring. And there was that period where XTC were kind of losing their tunes in a way. They were getting... the music was sounding a bit choppy and muso, and it didn't really appeal. And it sounded like he and his bandmates just needed to loosen up. And so they had that amazing, almost like playtime in the studio with John Leckie.
And apparently
that's,
it was
that's where you hear that warmth.
Apparently it's because they got fired off the Mary Margaret O'Hara album.
Yes.
Because she didn't like them and she thought there was something wrong with them.
Yes.
So, and then
yes.
like, we've got a fortnight and $5,000, what we do? Let's get the Dressing Up box out, which I think is absolutely fantastic.
Yes.
But I think you're right when you're talking about... what it meant for XTC themselves, because the subsequent XTC albums, Skylarkin, Oranges and Lemons, Nonsuch, are fantastic, and they're completely informed by Dukes of Stratosphere.
Yes.
And I think Andy Partridge said at the time, it was like, this is the band we always wanted to be when we were kids.
Yeah.
Apparently
yeah.
the name was actually the name he wanted for his band even before they were called the Helium Kids, and he thought it was too hippie-ish.
Yeah.
Then, but you know what, sod it, why not do it? Let's get the purple out, get the Granny Takes a Trip gear and the little Lennon specs, and totally went for it.
Yes.
And it's so joyful and so ridiculous. Everybody always mentions the Ruttles in connection with this, and I vastly prefer this, because with the Ruttles, although it's brilliant pastiche, they're trying, you know, Neil Innes is basically trying to anatomise and copy the biggest and best rock band there has ever been.
Yeah.
And what Andy Partridge, XTC and Colin Moulding are doing here is that it's like, these are bands who were there for a second and were gone.
You feel like they're using psychedelia as an inspiration and those bands as an inspiration, but this is actually them.
Yeah.
You know, he has said since, now I feel like we've become like our alter egos. You know, it's almost like this was them inside.
Apparently the band died in a horrible Sherbet accident.
Yes.
Sean, what do you think?
I didn't really like it.
Oh, God.
I love Skylarking. It's an amazing album. I love it. I can't say I don't love XTC, but this is just too kinksy. You know I don't like the Beatles. I know. People actually now write in when I say that.
I don't really like the Beatles. I don't listen to the Beatles.
Too derivative, man. It's
the Beatles are too derivative.
No, this is. I just found it really, really difficult to get on with. I played it and I played it again. There's no hook for me to. I just.
God, it's so hard.
There's a bit where, Vanishing Girl.
Yeah.
He's nicked the melody of The Lion Sleeps Tonight.
And the problem with that. Well, The Lion Sleeps Tonight is a rearrangement of an old melody anyway. It's an old Wimbleway.
True, but I couldn't get that. The psychedelia is so sort of slapped on. I know it's very him.
Hey,
I know,
Sean,
but...
we don't write music, we just borrow it, yeah? It's just out there.
I know, it just isn't, as one of your favourite phrases, isn't my wheelhouse. I was cooking some fajitas, it didn't work.
Oh, you should have done a mung beans gin, that would have been
better. Exactly, it was the wrong food. Maybe I needed to make a tagine.
Yeah, there was something Eastern like that.
Yeah.
I think Andy Partridge said around the time that, like, the psychedelic records he made were he liked, rather, the one things he loved were essentially kids' records made by grown-ups, taking all the techniques of a children's.
And is this not after when he went mad and refused to tour ever again, which is in that Sky documentary, which is really good. So this is his way of filtering all the madness into
it. Sort of like a healing period, in a way.
Yeah.
I like the idea of it. It was just listening to it found quite difficult.
I think, unfortunately, the people like the Stone Roses didn't really draw the right conclusions from this. Because the Stone Roses, it's like, yeah, man, it's serious music. Let's get Lecky in and we'll do serious rock. Actually, if you could kind of TARDIS back and force feed Noel Gallagher 25 o'clock or, you know, My Love Explodes, you might get a more exciting Oasis.
You might, Andrew Harrison. Yeah. You might not, though.
No, but their temperament's so different, though.
This is true.
Isn't it?
Mm. Yeah. Mm. Well, what I like about
when you think of Bonehead, no, it's not going to work.
Have you seen Bonehead lately? He looks like he's in the Dukes of the Stratosphere. Oh. He's got little purple glasses and beads and everything. He's totally gone for it, man.
Oh, right.
He's gone all mellow. Anyway, it's a 3 out of 4, Sean. You don't have to like it. It's not the law. That's Psonic. I'm going to say it again. Surroundabout Ride. A spectacular release. Now, Sean, what's up next?
Let's get back to the present day, Andrew Harrison, with another track from our guests. Lucy O'Brien, what have you brought in for us?
So I have brought in Home With You by FKA Twigs. This is her follow-up album to LP1. There's two tracks in particular that really stood out for me, one of which you can't play today, unfortunately, because the album's been put back. Thousand Eyes, which is extraordinary. It's kind of, I would say, a cross between Hildegard of Bingen, kind of medieval chant, and Roman Polanski. You know that awful film where, is it called Revulsion, where there's these hands that appear through... Yeah, Repulsion, where there's hands come through walls and this woman's going mad. And it kind of has that atmosphere. Home With You is the second track after Thousand Eyes, and it's in a similar vein. And she's playing with voice and echo and silence. And I love the way she's so imaginative with her voice and the kind of glitchy textures there.
Wonderful. Let's give it a listen. FKA Twigs, Home With You.
The more that people earn from you, the more you pull away, the more that they depend on you. I've never seen a hero like me in a sci-fi, so I wonder if you need to remember me. I wonder if you think that I can ever raise you up. I wonder if you think that I can ever help you fly. I've never seen a hero like me in a sci-fi, but I'd save a life if I thought it belonged to you. Mary Magdalene would never
Now, the Sky HBO adaptation of Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons' classic comic series Watchmen. 10 years after the blunt instrument that was Zack Snyder's movie version, Damon Lost Lindelof takes the alternate route of expanding what literally nobody is calling the Watchmen televisual universe. Long-time listeners will remember we talked about a DC Comics sequel a while ago, which I considered tantamount to drawing a moustache and glasses on the Mona Lisa. Lindelof calls his version a remix, but strictly speaking, it's an arm's-length sequel, set 34 years after the events of the comics and not in devastated New York, but in rural Tulsa, Oklahoma. Is it any good on its own merits? Fellow comics nut Dorian Linsky from our partner podcast, Romaniacs, came in to talk it over with me. And here's a taste of what you're getting.
We are no one. We are everyone. And we are invisible. Tick, tock, tick, tock, tick, tock.
We convinced ourselves that they were gone.
Tick.
But they were just hibernating.
Tick.
They came for everybody. Oh, please.
Are we safe?
I guess we have ourselves a reckoning.
What are you two talking about?
Oh, nothing. Just the end of the world.
who's going to watch The Watchmen on Sky Atlantic. Dorian Lynskey, welcome back to Big Mouth as our Watchmen, not Alan Moore correspondent. HBO can't really be accused of stinting on this, can it? A lot of money has been spent. Does it measure up? Does The Watchmen on HBO measure up to our current golden age of television before we assess it for fealty?
Well, it's too early to say, but it measures... I think what it is it's obviously from the guy that made The Leftovers.
Mm.
It really reminds me of The Leftovers. Season two more, because the thing is with season one is that he based it on the book The Leftovers, and then he sort of ran out of material. So season two was this really strange original piece of work, and this basically is... It's obviously the story of Watchmen, the Alan Moore, Dave Gibbons book. That's in the past here. So it's almost like he's just gone straight into it. I mean, there's lots of assumed knowledge, like little references to the comic, but then I actually think it functions even without them. It's not full of sort of mythology, and there's a lot of mystery there that is deliberate, and it's not just like, oh, you don't get it.
Yeah, so we're not in New York anymore. We're in Tulsa.
Right.
Where it's like... Watchmen, but what if racism? Mm. It made me realise that actually, you know, Watchmen the comic, although it sort of aspires to great American novel status, there's actually almost no race in there at all.
Right.
And this is kind of...
Well, remember that, you know, Alan Moore was British and he was doing an American story from a British perspective. And obviously there was plenty of racism in Britain in the 1980s, but it's not necessarily as sort of fundamental, and this makes it a very sort of Americanized story, because you're looking at the history of the kind of, you know, the starts with the Tulsa race riots in 1921, and it's a much more American perspective, and also obviously a more sort of modern perspective. It's like you want there to be a greater diversity of characters. You want there to be different things that you know, different areas to explore, different themes to explore, because what Moore was doing at the time was sort of, you know, deconstructing the superhero mythos, which has been done a billion times in comics and in movies. There's really nothing to be gained from going, what if superheroes but fucked up?
Yeah.
Like, there has to be a whole new story and a whole new kind of thematic focus.
And the core of Watchmen is if superheroes are real, they'd ruin the world.
Mm.
And now we see a part of the world that's kind of been ruined by the existence of superheroes. The police now have to... the police go... under masks because they are, you know, targeted as, but you know, by gangs. You've got effectively white supremacists who've adopted Rorschach, and I thought that was really interesting, because the Rorschach character being one of the big problematic anti-heroes of the world of comics, you know, people go, Rorschach is great, you know, you've got real problem there, because he's basically a Randite vigilante borderline fascist, isn't he? And now we've got the consequences of that.
Well, of course, we're in a more sort of... We are in a more kind of like race-conscious period, and in the 80s you could say, you know, and Frank Miller and The Dark Knight as well, you know, what if Batman was fascist, and Rorschach is the sort of Watchman's sort of Dark Knight figure. But fascist in a kind of like almost a sort of de-racialized way, that it was more just about your attitude to law and order. And now, of course, you can't extract race from a character like that, and so it's entirely logical that the Rorschach would become this kind of folk hero for a kind of like new clan, aren't they?
Yeah. And the other weird thing is that like dressing up as a superhero seems to have become the default reaction to stress. So we see, you know, members of the police force who've kind of made these vaguely shonky superhero costumes to disguise their identities. And the first thing we see is a kind of masked rider. I think it might be Hooded Justice from the comic in a film context, which shows the extent to which Lindelof has dug into the stuff. There's lots of tiny details like that. It's really about, you know, it's about masks and hiding behind masks, and that I think enables it to go off in all sorts of odd directions. There are things that about, you know, there's a quote in the comic, you know, from, I think it's something along the lines of, you know, there are times when it's necessary for justice to go masked. And people forget that comes from The New Frontiersman, which is basically a Breitbart publication in the comic.
Well, I think that there's a lot that we don't know yet. It's like that, you know, what he did a lot in The Leftovers was just withholding information and trusting the viewer to an extraordinary degree. Like, this is not going to... I mean, the theme tune to one of the seasons was called Let the Mystery Be. And it was almost like the lessons that he'd learned from Lost. So I suppose I'm seeing this through like the Lindelof prism rather than the Watchmen comic prism, because it's so different from the comic, and I do expect there to be, you know, various references and callbacks and explorations of the kind of the aftermath of those events. But there's just something brilliantly kind of fearless. It's the opposite, really, of the Zack Snyder movie, which was a real fanboy's attempt to
recreation,
do
the
most faithful recreation of the comic. And this, I mean, visually, it doesn't attempt to do that. Politically, it doesn't really attempt to do that. It's just a recognition of, like, I mean, I don't know. There were points where I just thought, does this even, if it wasn't for the Watchmen IP, which DC owns and is very lucrative and very enticing, would this even need to be the Watchmen
story?
Because
yeah.
the main characters, I mean, we are going to see, a little bit of Ozymandias. I think we're going to see, like, Silk Spectre return later. But actually, the meat of the story so far is not really that related to Watchmen. And so in that sense, it's a success from the off, as in it stands alone and it will succeed or fail as its own show.
Did you enjoy it?
Yeah, because I'm like into his whole thing. Yeah. I'm into basically being like, where's this going to lead? What's the relevance of that? Who's that character? Like, and to sort of trust him in a way that perhaps, you know, I think he earned back a lot of that trust that he lost with Lost.
Yeah.
Where he didn't answer questions, whereas here it's like, yeah, you're entering this world and there's so many things that aren't explored. The episode ends with a nasty surprise.
Mm-hmm. Which echoes a nasty surprise that begins the comic.
Yeah, so you're kind of, you're off to the races with all of these things you don't understand. So it's almost like you want to come back at the end of the season and go, okay, well, actually, this is how he's having a conversation with the comic. Because at the moment, all of that stuff really is deliberately unclear, and you just think, you know, how much is he going to use? Like in the Reign of Squid, the Reign of Tiny Squid.
Hallelujah.
Yeah.
Reigning Squid.
And it's obviously a little reference, but you're just like, well, I don't know what the logic behind that is, the fact that everybody just seems to take it for granted. Like all of these things about the world of Tulsa in whatever year it's meant to be, there's all these things we don't know that are being set up. Yeah.
I was all set up to really hate this, and I actually enjoyed it. I loved the fact that I thought what it took was the right stuff, which is when scenes of visual puns, as it were, in the comics. So you see the eggs in the bowl echoing the smiley. The little tiny details like the bakery called Milk and Hanoi, which sort of echoes the kind of alternate world punning Gunga Diner Indian restaurants. All those little bits I thought was really clever. I did not like the bloody explosion sort of penultimate battle. I thought that was vaguely gratuitous. But I'm kind of intrigued, and I'm going to stick with it. So we're off to the races. We're off to the racists.
And on to The Laundromat, the latest gleaming Netflix bauble starring La Streep, that's Meryl, David Schwimmer, Sharon Stone, Gary Oldman and Antonio Banderas. Based on the Panama Papers scandal, the billion-dollar tax evasion practices uncovered by an anonymous whistleblower in 2016, it sets out to tell us about evil money in plain and simple terms, with Streep operating as detective, Miss Marple crossed with Carol Cadwalader. Here's the trailer, My Beautiful Laundromat.
This is a story about money.
Money, money!
Bribery, corruption, millions and millions and millions of dollars. And they're trying to hide the whole thing.
Money, money!
There is more money than ever before!
Money, money! I just can't get enough.
It's controlled by a trust. A trust is like a fiduciary
agreement
under which a third party can... Okay, okay.
Money, money!
All I did wrong was try and send money.
That's the story?
The story is somebody died and somebody's making money from it.
Did we happen to mention we are in this for the money?
Give me that money. Somebody has to sound the alarm.
Now it's time to rinse and repeat.
Why take two bottles into the shower when you can watch and go? Or something. Sort of works, sort of doesn't. Lucy O'Brien, we are walked through the notion of current finances, shell companies, investor scams, etc., etc., at the beginning by the twin souls, Gary Oldman and Antonio Banderas, who play Jürgen Mossack and Raymond Fonseca. They are extremely camp. Lucy, does this work in introducing us to the world of A, the scandal, and B, what's going to follow?
I found the film a bit of a mishmash, and Antonio Banderas and Gary Oldman slightly irritating. And I know they're kind of meant to be, because those lawyers are really irritating. But it's a bit arch, you know, the way they're sort of introducing each story. And I can see what Soderbergh's trying to do, but I think you'd get more involved if you even just took one of those stories and really followed it through. So, for instance, the story that for me was most gripping was the girl that comes home to this multi-million dollar home and finds her father basically having sex with her best friend. And then he proceeds to try and bribe her so that she doesn't tell her mother. And he says to her, "Welcome to the world of adulthood. You know, my lawyer will talk to your lawyer and we'll just settle it with money," kind of thing. And that, for me, that in a way, that really crystallised what the film is trying to say, and the way money is moved around at that top 6% level in a way that absolutely infuriates everybody. I sort of feel the film is part of, you know, Fahrenheit 11/9, Michael Moore, this wonderful it's Sky Atlantic series, isn't it? Succession, where people are starting to take apart. You know, how does this big money work? Because it just oppresses so many people. But there was something about Laundromat that was trying to tackle a subject that's so huge and so complex. How can you do that?
Yes. David, I mean, this is being trailed as Streep's film, and she is indeed the first story within it. She's playing Ellen Martin, who is the widow of someone who, her husband who's died in an accident. She's trying to get an insurance claim.
And I think for a while, you think you're going to get Erin Brockovich or something like that. You think you're going to get this kind of, you know, hometown old lady who's going to finally crack the whole thing wide open. And it doesn't do that, and it deliberately doesn't do that. I mean, this whole thing is an exercise in what Brecht used to call the alienation effect, you know, the way of telling a story. And it's just like it says, look, don't get too immersed in the characters, the emotion, all of that. This is a story. This is about ideas. You know, this is this is actually a slightly didactic thing we're doing here. It's not that kind of drama. And Brecht was kind of, it's one of
his... It's a very good parallel, actually.
Theatrical devices. So, you know, and that, therefore, you know, they kind of head off for that. Meryl Streep kind of disappears for a while, and they go and tell all these other stories, like these weird little things about the poor guys, you know, talking about UB40's red, red wine, and 3 minutes later they're being dug a shallow grave because one of them went into the bath, what they thought was the bathroom, and sort
That's
of
a Mexican drug
the wrong
one,
people.
Isn't
it? Exactly, and I agree with Lucy that particular story in the middle that you were referring to is perhaps the most arresting. But once again, you know, you're almost like you're not supposed to sort of stay on it too long because this is about something else. And I think we're trying to focus on the whole appalling financial structure of modern time. I mean, I'm such a simpleton, unfortunately, that while I rage against kind of economic inequality, even when people try and explain it to me in very rudimentary terms, like, you know, here is a carrot, here is a banana, sorry, can you make it simpler? I'm just terrible like that, unfortunately. And I think that it is an important issue, and I think that I do, while I would recommend that people see it while not giving it a hearty, hearty endorsement, I do find Gary Oldman's accent in it.
Oh,
with Gary Oldman,
it's weird, didn't it?
Accent,
at least we know that Dracula got a job after he was Dracula.
Absolutely.
You know, he went to Panama.
That's horrendously distracting. But it's quite an all-star cast. I mean, Sharon Stone crops up at some point as the Rialto, which is...
David Schwimmer.
David Schwimmer, of course, in there. And various other people that sort of, you know, great and good, you know.
It's the kind of thing you can get if you're Steven Soderbergh, isn't it? Like, literally every big is an Oscar winner.
But I thought it was interesting. I mean, I wouldn't say it was by any means a qualifying test. And as you say, I think it's such an invidious task to try and take in the whole scope of something like that, that I would recommend that people see it despite its flaws.
Andrew, does it make a difference that Mossack Fonseca have launched defamation action against Netflix and it's still ongoing? Does it make it a more exciting watch?
Well, it seems they have hit something. If they're suing it, you're doing something right.
Yes.
I thought I mean, all the reasons why you guys didn't seem to like it were the reasons I liked it. Essentially, to me, this is a polemic with snapshots.
Mm-hmm.
This is a heavily stylized, heavily kind of, in a lot of ways, heavily camped up.
Yes, it's very
often
camp.
Ridiculous way of telling an immensely serious story. Mm. And I think that's actually the right approach. I mean, you're right, David, you sort of are expecting Erin Brockovich, but Erin Brockovich has already been made.
That's right. It's as well not to have that. Yeah. I think that's a good decision.
And I like the fact that we have several strands. It's almost like comedy sketches. Mm. So we see that we've got the ongoing tale of the Meryl Streep character and her attempt simply just to get the insurance payment for her husband's death in a boating accident. She's not asking for the world. Running alongside that, we've got the story of the African, we're not quite sure if he's a politician or a business potentate, but he's a rich guy from Africa living in the United States, who his purpose there is, as you said, Lucy, to say, look, you know, ultimately at this level, money controls everything. Money is power. Power is money. Then we have the story of set in China, of a Western businessman.
That's really chilling.
gets involved, gets in a little bit too deep in pre-bribery China. Again, pretty much a true story. And all of these things are presented not as narrative threads, but almost as little vignettes to illustrate a point. And Gary Oldman and Antonio Banderas, who sometimes look like Father Ted and Dougal at the Euro Song Contest in their sparkly jackets, and they sometimes look like Neil and Chris in the "What Have I Done to Deserve This" video.
Yes.
They are a kind of two-man Greek chorus double act, commenting on the action, but also in the action, and also commenting on themselves, saying, "But what did we know? All we were doing was providing terrible services to awful people. That's not our fault."
Yes.
Jazz hands.
Right.
In a way, I think it's the only way to tell this story in the form of a film. Otherwise, you are dealing, much better approach with a book or investigative magazine articles. So I actually, although it's about a horrible thing, found it immensely enjoyable and acid test. So does my wife, who has to be frog marched in front of films and made to sit in front of them at gunpoint. She just doesn't like the cinema film, and she really enjoyed it. She found it, illuminative, entertaining.
Mm-hmm.
Antonio Banderas is fantastically magnetic. I actually like...
He's very good in it.
I like Gary Oldman in his mega camp mode. But we should also... I mean, the fact that every little tiny walk-on is... It's David Schwimmer in a very serious role.
He's brilliant.
It's Robert Patrick from the Terminator.
Yeah, Robert Patrick, absolutely.
There's a cracking reveal at one point, which you won't reveal. I actually found it immensely entertaining, and I sort of think he's maybe hit upon a new little genre here, the comic polemic. The comic, the 90-minute fast show political track.
Well, as Dave was saying, though, it's Brecht, so it's not that new.
No,
it is very Brecht.
Was Brecht on Netflix? I don't think he was, Sean.
Brechtflix.
Brechtflix.
Yeah, that's what we're going to
buy that URL.
Okay, so I have a question that's related to that. So does it, though, just stick in your craw a little bit that Netflix, the giant streaming service that probably likes evading, not avoiding, a little bit of tax here and there, is bringing this stuff out? How do we feel? Because Netflix is a populist platform. It's going for views, it's going for money.
But that's
and then
capitalism.
We have a lot of, really lovely actors saying, this is wrong,
capitalism.
Actors who live in really lovely houses. And we're just like,
To its credit, at one point...
Yeah. Andrew's pointing at the moment.
I am pointing. Yeah. To its credit, at one point, Mossack and Fonseca do say...
You can say it.
The producer of this, the director of this film, has five shell companies.
Yes. Mm.
The
yes.
writer has a shell company.
Yes.
I know, but does that make it better?
Rupert Murdoch allows himself to be mocked in The Simpsons.
It felt a bit Gary Barlow, that bit, though, didn't it? It's like, if you say it, does that make it all right?
No, it doesn't make it all right at all, I suppose.
But what it does say is, look, this is happening in the world and we need to understand it. And, okay, there is... it's a bit of a thin excuse to say I was just playing within the rules. It's a bit of a better excuse if you're not the person who makes the rules. If you're the person who makes the rules and says I was just playing within them, bit more of a tissue thin defence, I think.
It's Netflix that needs to fix itself, not the film.
So
what, by paying more tax?
Yes.
Netflix.
I don't know what Netflix's tax position is, but certainly
we don't.
Large corporation.
We don't. I'm sure they pay lots of tax. It's just
I'm sure they do more than.
But then the alternative to that is that
is you put it on Mubi and no one watches it.
Yeah, and also that nobody who is any way compromised can. It's the same argument that says, so you think there ought to be a higher income tax? Why don't you give all your money away and then we'll talk about it?
Yes.
If I give all my money away, it would make no difference whatsoever. It will be a drop inside a drop inside a drop inside the ocean. Whereas if you argue for a fairer system in general, and we all just pay our taxes, not moaning about it. Anyway, it's a light entertainment podcast, Sean. I really
all
like
right.
it. I really like it, and I would recommend this. A lot of my friends think it's a total mess.
I thought it had a lot in common with The Politician.
I think it's a really important instruction lesson in a way, and it's a film that everyone should watch. But is it part of an echo chamber? Because I was talking to someone about this last night, and they said, but doesn't it just affirm your worldview? You know, how
well,
are
you can
to
say
get
that about anything.
Just watching it,
it's based on a book called Secrecy World, and from what I can see, they're repackaging and remarketing the book to coincide with this release. So maybe people will read more about it and say just a bit more transparency would be good in the world, wouldn't it?
Absolutely.
So should we recommend it to all our friends?
Yes,
totally. Yeah, I mean, flawed as it is, definitely, because I think the nature of the subject matter.
Recommended within the bubble. There we go, and that's the end of the show, which means closing time chatter. What are our guests going to be discussing over a hot sake in an office over a Tokyo fish market? As in Girihaji. Lucy O'Brien, what's your closing time chatter for this week?
So my closing time chatter, I'd like to remember Kim Shattuck, who was the lead singer-songwriter of a punk pop band called The Muffs, who had a lot of success, well, from the 90s, all through the 90s. And I got a real soft spot for their kind of driving, optimistic tunes. And she was... what I liked as well was her fearlessness. And she died earlier this month. And the Muffs have just released a double album of songs that she's written between 91 to 2017. And they were all fresh recordings. I think it's a lovely tribute. And, I just wanted to remember her, really.
Fantastic. David Stubbs, what's your closing time chatter?
Chris Needs, who used to be editor of Zig Zag, veteran music journalist, and he's just published part one of his memoir about the year 1969. And it's called Just a Shot Away, Rolling Stones reference there. There's obviously a lot of this kind of thing at the moment. There's been a lot of retrospection about the year 1969. It's 50 years ago, et cetera, et cetera. And there's a couple of truisms about 1969. It was the year of, like, sort of terminal decline of Altamont, the Manson family, et cetera, et cetera.
This is what the late David Cavanagh described as when the summer of love turned into the autumn of Arg.
Yes, along those lines, and I think that's been, the Tarantino, the various things have kind of reinforced that. But Chris Needs would have been 15 in 1969. And, I mean, that's the age of blazing epiphanies, I think, if you go on to sort of be a really impassioned music fan and writer or whatever. And the wonderful thing about this book, and it only covers the first 6 months, is it really, it blazes with all of the, blazes with epiphanies. There are so many kind of things. There's so many, 1969 isn't a year of like a terminus. It's teeming with activity, and Chris Needs, fortunately, his taste is so broad, he takes it all in. So it isn't just the Stones, although he's a big Stones fan. It isn't just the Beatles, it's MC5, Sun Ra, Moondog, Trapmass Replica, it comes out that year. And countless sort of names and things like that, the people that just came and went, that same year, or had sort of a brief flourishing and then went into a steep decline, and it's all in there, and that makes it such a kind of wonderful, inspiring read. It's also, rather sadly, his partner, who's also an author, Helen, she died while he was writing it, and she sort of cast a shadow over it, although they weren't together in 1969. She's sort of helped him, he refers to it, throughout the text, and she really helped him kind of shape the text, inspire him to kind of, think about it and think through what he'd thought about and reshape it and edit it, and that's a very, that's a kind of very moving aspect as well.
And it's out now, or is it coming out?
It's out pretty much now. Yeah.
Fantastic, Sean. Your closing time chatter.
I just wanted to remember similarly Deborah Orr, who was a force of nature. I didn't know her, but at 57, died a couple of days ago. Was a fantastic person, a really good writer. Had her own struggles, which she put a lot on Twitter in the last few months. But just to say, people like that are rarer than you think. People who really... She edited Weekend for Guardian a long time, was Guardian columnist as well. She, I think she sent Kathy Hacker to interview the Spice Girls, which I think is my favourite fact. And for someone, to just think outside of what is normal reporting and to be someone who praised drinking at lunchtime and just be just a massively fantastic human. Thank you for all of that.
Well, my closing time chatter is much more trivial than yours. I was at the sound system of the People's Vote Brexit March on Saturday. The sound system was superintended by Soho Radio, where we're recording right now, and it's brilliant. There was a load of top class DJs, all getting 12 minutes each. So Bicep, Ed Chemical, Secret Sundays, loads of them. They all got 12 minutes, so you've got to really think hard. Mm. But my favourite bit was after the vote came through, delaying what we thought was going to be the final verdict on Brexit, the MC went, shout out to Oliver Letwin. I've never been at a rave where anyone can shout out to Oliver Letwin.
That's and you great. Never will again.
Probably never will again, but Oliver Letwin.
Oh, don't know, let's make it a meme.
Shout out to Oliver Letwin. Yeah, I mean, they'll all be doing it in Mixmag. So I just wanted to ring that bell.
So that was a real rewind.
But rewind, shout going out to them. I like Oliver Letwin.
Wonderful. That's the end of this week's show. Next week, weather permitting, we'll be doing Michael Kiwanuka's album plus Terminator Dark Fate. Are we finally on for a decent Terminator movie for the first time in 27 years? Although T2 is quite good.
That's the one I'm talking about. That's great. Anyway, carry on.
Lucy and David are sticking around to choose their favourite binge box sets in the Extra Bit. Thank you both for coming in. Thanks from me, Andrew, and producer Alex Rees. We're going to play out with a bit more Dusty, hooray, from 1977, her little-known bangers period. This is a bit of the Tom Moulton mix of That's the Kind of Love I've Got for You. It's well worth finding the full 7 minutes on the internet. It will raise your spirits like nobody's business. We'll see you next week. Until then, keep it dusty.